So the last point I want to make is I want to show you the scale we're talking about. And this is up here. Now, John Wren, this is on his website. It's going to be on my campaign website soon, as soon as we do a little more work on it. John Wren, do people know who Seymour Mailman was?
Yeah.
You know, peace conversion and trying to say deindustrializing the country was not a smart idea. Seymour passed in the early 2000s. John was his research assistant for 20 years. What are you saying?
Lights.
Oh, yeah, turn the lights down, maybe do so can see it better. So, John is the country's foremost expert on what it's going to take to do a Green New Deal. Not just energy, but all productive sectors. We don't have machine tool industry. Without that, we can't build intermediate goods or consumer goods. We can't build solar panels, wind generators, heat pumps. We got to ship them in from out of the country. So this is part of revitalizing the economy. Plus, you can go to 100% clean power, but if factories are still polluting, if agriculture is still polluting, we haven't zeroed out greenhouse gas emissions. So this is a plan to go through all the productive sectors and transform them to be sustainable using clean energy. So I'm just going to scroll through you this, if I can do this, just to show you what's up here. Now, John wrote a book in 2010 when we're running for the Green New Deal. In the middle of the campaign, it's called Manufacturing Green Prosperity. Remember, we're coming out of the Great Recession, and part of the Green New Deal was not just dealing with climate crisis, then it was dealing with the economic crisis. That was really the spearhead. So his book was a big contribution, and it was about rebuilding the industry on a sustainable basis. Now, it says 20 years. That's where, you know, I'm working with John to make this on a faster timeline. In 2010, when his book came out, which a lot of this is based on, 2030 was 20 years away. The climate science hasn't changed, so that deadline still applies. So, keeping that in mind, here is an outline. The Green New Deal is a green economy reconstruction program plus the Economic Bill of Rights. And I'm not going to go through all the sectors, but you can see, first thing is electricity, but that's only 28% of emissions. So we need green buildings where, for example, instead of relying on heat and relying on natural gas for heat, we rely on geothermal heat pumps, which use clean electricity and heat and cool your house. And under each of these, there's descriptions and there's further reading under some of them, so people can get educated as well as know what the bottom lines are in each sector. So you see over here, total jobs in each sector, how many of those in manufacturing, how many billions a year it will cost. So it deals with electricity, buildings, with a program of housing for all, transportation reconstruction, basically rails, freight rails, high-speed rails between cities, public transportation in the cities, and then where we still have vehicles, they're zero-emission electric vehicles. Food and environmental reconstruction, so that's regenerative agriculture. Big employment here, $4 million a year, is Civilian Conservation Corps. That's rebuilding forests, mangroves, wetlands, habitats, because not only do we have to stop emitting greenhouse gases, we got to draw it back into the biosphere. Because we're over the 350 parts per million that's been popularized by Bill McKibben. We're at 415 last month. We got to draw it down, not just stop releasing it. So that's a big thing, and that's part of the Global Green New Deal. Water infrastructure, green machinery reconstruction. This is rebuilding manufacturing in the country, and then we're going to do it globally. So that comes from military spending cuts, recycling. So then we get to the Economic Bill of Rights, and we got costs here, job guarantee. Now, this creates so many jobs. Let me get back up there. So, yeah, when we talk about redoing all these sectors, that's 20 million jobs a year, okay? Unemployment now, I think last time I looked was percentage, I think it came to like, the highest measure was like 9.3 million. So labor is the bottleneck in making this transition. Studies going back to the 90s show that. So anybody that says it's jobs versus the environment doesn't know what they're talking about. 5.6 million manufacturing jobs, and that is over here 1.7 trillion a year in investment, public investment. Then the Economic Bill of Rights, this covers, now we put the high-speed internet so we get rid of the digital divide as part of tuition-free public college, universal child care and pre-K, fixing up our school facilities. So this comes to another 4 million jobs including 300,000 in manufacturing, and about 1.2 trillion. So now how we pay for it, we tax the rich, the ecological taxes. We got the green, you know, I call them green, but modern greenback proposal, greening the dollar in there. We also got green QE, that's borrowing money. I won't go into details on that. Cut the military budget by 75%, war on drugs, abolish ICE, save a lot of money. So basically, bottom line, it's about a $3 trillion a year program, and we've identified revenue nearly $4 trillion. So this can be paid for. And that, I just wanted to give you an idea of what's coming so that hopefully when we get this done, all our candidates can use it to answer that question. Well, how are you going to pay for it? How much is it going to cost? We got some good ballpark figures here. And we got an idea of the scope. You know, when AOC got the attention, some Republican think tank came up with a $93 trillion figure, which sounded really scary. It turns out they didn't know what they're talking about, but they threw that out there. It was tweeted all over. This will give us some grounding in reality that we can use in our campaigns. So with that, that's an outline of Eco-Socialist Green New Deal and what the budget for it might look like. The thing is, it's probably going to be a little bit more expensive because we've got to move faster. But there's a leverage thing. Obama's stimulus for the environmental stuff, the clean energy stuff, for every public dollar, 39 private dollars was leveraged. We've used in studies of the carbon tax in New York a 10-to-1 leverage, conservative. If we just did a 2-to-1 leverage, I mean, we could double it if it's twice as expensive to move twice as fast, just to give you an idea. So those are the kind of things that John and people in my campaign and I will be working on, and hopefully we'll have this out there in final form very soon. And thank you.
Thank you, Howie, and thank everybody for coming out this afternoon. My comments will be relatively brief. I think Howie has laid out a framework of understanding of this Green New Deal challenge that's very important. As Howie said, candidates can use this around the country in our education and agitational work. I'm going to speak to one other component that we need to include. Howie mentioned the fact that one of the essential elements excluded from the Democrats' Green New Deal was the issue of the military and militarism. And as we all know, that concern was always a part, a central component of the Green New Deal platform and program. That basically, not only is the military the largest institutional consumer of fossil fuels, it is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. Makes up something like 5% of all the global warming that takes place on this planet. But the question for us has always been, well, what is the role of the military politically? It's quite obvious that it is a polluter, that it wastes precious resources. Why is there such a reluctance to address the issue of the military within the context of the Green Party the Democratic Party platform? Well, the answer basically is because there is a common recognition and a common interest that in order for the ruling elements to maintain their hegemony, they are committed to using military force. That the military plays a vital role in perpetuating the hegemony of this state and the Western project. That the commitment to full spectrum dominance isn't just something that was created by the Trump administration. It's been the platform and set of values advanced since the end of the so-called Cold War. They are committed to maintaining their dominance. Therefore, propping up the military is an essential part of that strategy. And we have to understand that, because the fight for a Green New Deal requires us to have this kind of information, of course, but also requires we understand that we have a political fight on our hands. that we have to struggle, that this has to be seen as part of a revolutionary transitional program, that the objective has to be to shift power from the ruling elements back to the people. To demonstrate that, we know that right now the Congress is involved in a conversation around the military, increasing once again the military budget. The Trump administration, they have issued 3 military budgets. This is the third one. And each year, they have increased military spending with almost no opposition from the oppositional party. This year, they have committed to raising military spending between $733 billion, this was passed in the House, and $750 billion passed in the Senate. Now they have to go through this reconciliation process. But the point is that both parties are committed to extending, expanding, increasing military spending. Mm-hmm. Because both parties have a common interest. That is, again, to maintain the hegemony of the system and the ruling elements here in this country. And we have to understand and recognize that what we are involved in right now, my friends, is in fact a class war, a one-sided war. Mm-hmm. So when we recognize that we are in this kind of struggle, that we understand the kind of political work that we have to do, it provides us a source of inspiration, but it is also a source of soberness in terms of the task that we have before us. Because no other major electoral party in this country has the ability, the background, the history, to take up this task. That's our responsibility as the Green Party. So this issue of militarism and war is essential. It is part of the interlocking crisis that we're facing, the issue of climate change, cannot be disconnected from war and militarism. And we have to make sure that we are able to communicate that to the public. The issue that Howie touched on in terms of, I hope people understand the implications. When Howie talks about the fact that we have to shift public ownership from these energy companies to the people, that's a major undertaking. Yeah. That's part of the pushback in the so far one-sided class war, that we have to struggle and build a movement in order to, in fact, effect that kind of shift in power from the energy companies and the ruling class back to us. Because these folks are not going to give this up without a fight, without a struggle. That right now, you know, they are pretending, some of them, to be committed to a green transformation and all of this. But we also know that they are salivating at the prospect of increasing the use of fossil fuels over the next decade by 40%. These folks are not going to allow us to just build a movement without pushback to take away their profits. And we've got to be prepared for this kind of fight, this kind of struggle. If we're really serious about trying to save ourselves and save the planet. So it's an issue of politics that we have to put front and center in this struggle. We can talk about the fact to remind people that part of our public educational responsibility is to let people know about the 800 or more bases around the world that the U.S. is involved in. And this, again, is part of their offensive capability, that they are basically prepared to wage war to maintain the hegemony of the U.S. and, in fact, the entire Western European colonial project. So, my friends, we have to have a program that recognizes these realities. We have to call on ourselves and agitate among the public to demand that These individuals who are up for public office, who are running in either one of the parties or all the parties, that they take certain positions. And one position is that they need to commit themselves to reducing military spending by at least 50%, maybe 75%. But we have to put that on the table. That we have to make the connection between military spending and war, making war abroad, and the war being waged against people in this country domestically. So we have to end the 1033 program, that program responsible for militarizing police forces across this country. Okay?
Yeah.
We have to raise the issue of mass incarceration. We've got to talk about the fact that communities like my community are still being subjected to executions by the police forces. So we have to make these national and international connections and remind people that we are in fact in a struggle for ourselves, in a struggle for this nation, and in a struggle for the world. So making those connections, grounding this understanding within the context of our commitment to the Green New Deal, understanding that what we have to agitate for is to see this as a transitional program and not an end in itself. For me, to do otherwise is sort of bullshitting the people. Because basically, we're not talking about the radical transformation of the structures and institutions of this society, this state, then we are propping up the hegemony of this liberal, corrupt order. So the task for us, my friends, is struggle. It's building a powerful revolutionary Green Party. Tell no lies, claim no easy victories, build a powerful people's movement, and let's make history.
Musical chairs. So thank you all for being here and for leading the charge. And once again, as Greens, we find ourselves in position of the ones we've been waiting for. We are the ones we've been waiting for. The Democrats are not going to do this for us. AOC is not going to do this for us. Nobody else is going to. Nancy Pelosi is not going to do this for us. You know, once again, it's coming down to us. And I want to just add three quick points, and then we can open this up, because it is about us, and it's about us being as empowered and compelled as we possibly can be, because, you know, our lives and the future, you know, really does depend on what we do now. We have, you know, the remarkable responsibility, privilege, power, whatever you would call it, to decide whether there's going to be a future or not. It really comes down to what happens here, probably in the next 10 years, arguably. Increasingly, that's what the science suggests. Some are arguing the fact that it's even a shorter time window than that, because decisions, policy decisions that get made, need to get made now so that we can really make big inroads in the next 10 years, which is what we've been calling for, actually, you know, for decades here in the Green Party. So I wanna address the recent developments in the science and in the real world that compel the Green New Deal, not the Democrat Green New Deal or the ALC Green New Deal. It really does come down again to the Green New Deal. So I'm gonna say why that is and why we should be very proud and very relentless in, and I would say very much on the offensive. This is not about trying to justify, but just proceeding with incredible conviction that, you know, this is the prize. We need to keep our eyes on the prize and not be apologetic about it. This is what we're going for. I'm going to talk about the science and just the real world aspects that compel that. Say a few words about, you know, what makes it absolutely crystal clear that the Democrats have no intention of going there, why it really does fall to us and no one else. And then Thirdly, I want to just say a couple things about strategies. You know, how do we, us, make this happen? This is a big plan, and it calls for a lot of resources. What can we do in our communities right now that actually helps build the momentum for this? And I'm going to come back to, you know, this concept that's been out there for quite a while, that we need a global climate strike for people, planet, and peace over profit. And we need to do convergent organizing as we build towards the general strike. And I just want to throw that out for us to begin, you know, wrestling with that concept, which is actually not such a hard concept to wrestle with. You know, once you begin to think about it, it just makes more and more sense, at least for me. So I want to just talk about some thinking that's going on there. So first, about the urgency, depending on how much of a geek you are, how much of a, you know, a policy wonk you are following this stuff, there have been a lot of developments really just in the last couple of weeks. And it's not only, you know, the 117 degree Fahrenheit heat in France. It's not only the heat waves that are off the charts. It's not only the Midwest farms that are underwater, you know, the fires that turn California cities to ashes in a matter of hours. It's also, you know, it's the monsoons, which have displaced millions of people, including thousands of refugees, Rohingya refugees, actually, and, you know, this incredible convergence of social and economic injustice and displacement and racism together with the climate crisis. You know, they are all, these are convergent crises, and we need to fight them in a convergent way with convergent solutions, which certainly the Green New Deal is, and we need to be on the ground organizing for it in a convergent way as well, and I'll come back to the organizing. You know, so we have the floods, the heat, and then there have been recent revelations about ice sheets, in particular in the Antarctic, which are somewhat new. Are people familiar with the rather daunting news coming out of the Antarctic? You know, it's not really being covered out there a lot, but, you know, as Greens, we tend to look pretty deep. So just to summarize, the Antarctic contains a lot of sea level frozen in ice. And it used to be said, oh, don't worry, it'll be millennia away. But right now, we're looking at the potential abrupt collapse of a major ice sheet. So this is the Thwaites Glacier, which is the backstop for the whole Western Antarctic ice sheet, which totally contains about 10 feet of sea level.
Wow.
And so the Thwaites, which is this critical backstop against the flow into the sea of the other glaciers, which are all beginning to accelerate towards the sea. This Thwaites Glacier has a hole that was discovered 1 year ago, wasn't there 3 years before that. So this is a really rapid developing problem. This hole is about the size of Manhattan, and it is deep in the glacier, and it has raised the prospect of a sudden catastrophic collapse of that glacier, the Thwaites, which holds 2 feet of sea level, a potential precipitous 2-foot sea level rise. And nobody has the slightest clue what the dynamics of these glaciers are and how they would collapse. It can't be modeled. So it's not part of the climate negotiations that led to 1.5 degree centigrade limit that we're struggling to meet, well, in fact, you know, for which they've said, get halfway there, eliminate half of emissions by 2030, and the other half by 2050. That's basically what the most recent IPCC report said. It said, we have till 2050, as long as we get halfway there by 2030. Well, you know, as Greens, we've been saying, we've been more informed by Jim Hansen and other really leading lights in the climate research community who've said it's really got to be done by 2030. So at any rate, totally outside of this Western calculus that came up with the 2050, you have these other things that are happening. So this accelerated breakup of the Antarctic ice sheets that could raise sea level very rapidly. First 2 feet, and then 8 feet following that at an uncertain rate. And then the other real accelerator here is the rate at which the glaciers are disappearing, which supply water. In South Asia alone, it's about 1.5 billion people, or 10% of the world's population, which faces drought and elimination of their drinking water by 2030. That is the rate at which this is going. So this is not part of that calculus that you know, that would allow you to sort of sit back and wait for the democratic plan, which is at best 2050, you know, and even at that, they're mostly targeting electricity by 2050, which in turn is only about 30%, 25 to 30% of the whole, you know, the whole greenhouse gas burden. So we need to organize for the real Green New Deal, like our lives depend on it. And if it's not our lives, it's certainly the lives of the next generation, and it's certainly the lives of the frontline communities and coastal communities, as well as islands and low-lying nations and so on. You know, this is not, you know, this is not something that can be negotiated. Nature doesn't negotiate. You know, this is just what we have to do and get the word out as we do it about why. You know, people are really, I think, very alarmed and insecure right now because they see what's going on around them. So there's a lot of momentum that we can build on. I won't take time to talk about the Democrats because I want to be sure I end here in another moment, and it's, you know, it's just not worth talking about Democrats. So I think we all know that they're not going to do it. They have basically dumbed down the Green New Deal so that they're now talking about 2050, maybe, you know, but lots of people now are just using the Green New Deal as their brand to say that they're interested in green jobs, and green jobs are better than fossil fuel jobs, and they're calling that their Green New Deal. So, you know, this is another case in which we didn't just change the debate, we won the debate without even being in it. We won it. Yay. And it's just one of the ways in which that's happening. And so I just want to underscore that this is a convergent crisis across the many domains of people, planet, and peace over profit. So to fight it, we've got to be all of those domains working together. And I would say here in the eastern Massachusetts, eastern seaboard area, we're really interested in beginning to discuss this concept of a convergent strike force, where we begin to plan for the general strike, which is not simple and it's not easy, and if you do it seriously, there's a lot of work that and preparation that has to go into it. But part of that is developing our network. So the thinking is, well, what if we began to develop these emergency response networks that could come out on a moment's notice for defense against ice raids, for to support labor strikes at UPS or wherever, to fight critical pipeline battles or healthcare legislation, et cetera, if we begin cross-linking our networks. And there are lots of networks that are primed to move right now, and that includes the Fridays for the Future, the student strikes, the you know, Extinction Rebellion. Labor is out striking now, you know, in an incredibly big and inspired way, and the teachers and retail workers and so on. There are many forces now which are really primed, but they all have a different piece of the puzzle. The Green New Deal puts the whole puzzle together. So to begin to develop a strike force that would be working for a global Green New Deal and a global people strike for basically people, planet, and peace. So we're also an emergency response force when they're threatening to invade Venezuela again, or Iran, or, you know, Cuba, or, you know, God knows where the next one is. We develop, you know, we begin to exercise this networking together. It's a great way to begin actually articulating this and building the movement for it, because clearly, most people are being thrown under the bus right now in every way imaginable, but don't hear from the usual suspects, that is the political establishment, you know, they are denied a sense of our agency and our power, you know. And remember, the largest voting bloc is the bloc that's not voting, you know, because they don't buy the two toxic solutions that are being rammed down their throats. You know? So it's an opportunity for us to begin networking and actually building on the power that in fact we do have to really bring about substantive change, so that our goal is to bring the wheels of destruction, that is economic, ecological, and military destruction, and human rights as well, to bring all of those wheels of destruction to a grinding halt in a combined boycott, strike, direct action, etc., that's coordinated across many networks to actually have real impact, so that we look like what happened in Puerto Rico over the course of the last week. But hundreds of times over, thousands of times over, across movements and across borders, because we're all in this together, and when we get together, we are absolutely unstoppable. So, thank you.
Okay, let's have a discussion. I'm going to take maybe five folks and then have the panel respond. If we have more time, we'll do it again. And ask you to limit your comment or question to 90 seconds so we can get a lot of people here. And so, one, two, three, four, five. And sorry for the ones I didn't count, but let's go in that order and then we'll go.
The Green New Deal calls for...
Excuse me, do you mind identifying yourself just so people know who you are? Everybody should do that.
Joshua Gerloff, Green Rainbow Party, Massachusetts. The Green New Deal calls for a lot of renewables, and I believe that will basically create like a whole new industry. All of these minerals come from Africa, and it requires slavery, child labor, and we're basically creating like a whole new industry. That's going to add to, you know, it's just another industry, you know. And there's more gentle things, and I believe that the Green New Deal should include a statement for best practices that citizens can do in their own lives. There was a campaign when they were introducing the CFL that, like, if every household replaced just one light bulb with a CFL, we could close one power plant. You might remember this. Well, I don't know if that worked or not, but I think it sold a few of the CFLs. The New Deal should definitely include something like that. Something like take less. Have one less child, go vegan. Going vegan is huge.
Yes, that would help.
There's a broad consensus, both like in the sciences watching the climate numbers, there's a broad consensus that regenerative agriculture doesn't work as well as we hope it does. Veganism means they'll stop cutting down the rainforest to grow soy, to feed cows. If you follow the whole chain of supply of animal agricultures, it's incredible, and it contributes 51% of all greenhouse gas.
Next, thank you.
Okay. Number two. I went this way. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm Frank Jeffers. I'm on the Echo Action Committee, and I'm from the Green Rainbow Party of Massachusetts. And one of the things we're doing in Echo Action is gearing up to provide some specifics in the Green New Deal and also in the Green Party platform. And one of the things we're doing here is, don't let the game get changed the game. And one of the ways to do that is by changing the technology. There's huge amounts of technology from the past that are not being used. Greta Thunberg has said that everything is going to have to change. And that's where it's at. And this business is already well underway, global warming.
and it's going to get worse. And there's no such thing as holding it off, because it's already here. And there's going to be a thousand things that are going to have to be changed, and, you know, a thousand different steps we're going to have to take to bring things back into balance. Anybody that says they got a silver bullet is going to fix this. It's full of shit up to no good. Because that's not going to happen. No silver bullet's going to fix this. Everything's going to have to change. And what we are getting into, you know, some of the technology you just had in insulated houses, like I saw in Iceland, and certainly in Europe, reducing the size of the houses. We have 30-40% of the housing in the United States probably have to be replaced in the next 30 years. So you replace it with energy efficient small units that people can afford to pay for. This is the kind of thing that can be done. And, you know, specifics. It's a couple of specifics out of about 100 people.
Okay.
Okay.
Wayne Turner, North Carolina. Regarding the, you have two comments. Regarding the issue of developing policies and getting a broad agreement on moving, or at least something that's already moving forward on the Green New Deal. The BBC published an article yesterday in which a climate scientist at the head of climate organizations suggested that the policy making arm government, with whatever impetus for getting this done by 2030, would have to be in place by the end of 2020. So really, we have like 18 months instead of 10 years to get solve this problem. The second comment concerns your infrastructure bank that creates money. You say match money created by the private sector at $500 billion. Considering that the U.S. military has burned trillions of dollars in wars in the Middle East and abroad, and considering the general behavior of the private sector in general, I'm concerned that the requiring the private sector to provide up to $500 billion in the necessary money is going to give capitalists and the financial community a way to influence this that we might or rather not be involved in.
Okay, fourth one?
Yep. I just want to, I'll keep mine very short. There's a subject we should all become aware of. It's called a constituent assembly. Other countries use it. They use it quite well. Cuba just wrote a new constitution using a constituent assembly. And then, so for us, in these convergent crises, we're going to have to, maybe veganism might be over the top, but we're going to have to change our lifestyle. We can't live the way we are with less energy. So the constituent assembly, we can use that just as an example, to discuss what kind of lifestyle can fit in with the Earth. So just try to study up on constituent assembly. It's a very intriguing subject, and that's it.
Okay, last one, and then we'll get some responses.
My name is Mike. I'm in the Greater Boston chapter in Green Rainbow Party, and I'll just be very, very brief. I am speaking at the annual meeting of the Green Party of the United States. I'm speaking to the leadership of my national party. Why is it that my national party can't set some priorities? There's a reason why the Democrats stole our idea again, right? It's because we don't make it a priority. We have a couple candidates making a big campaign, and that's it. We have a lot of members around the country. We have a lot of chapters around the country. I would recommend that the National Party make this, and it could be a couple of other things, major priorities, which we recommend, not require. We recommend that all members of the Green Party, the United States, consider working on this, and all state parties make this a priority.
Okay. I'm looking at the time. We had all men in that one. I know two women have flagged me, so I'm going to let them ask their questions, and then we'll have about 3 minutes each from those of us who spoke to make a response. So I got Sherry and Amber, and I think when they, well, let's see, we maybe get a couple more. but let's get them in there because we're supposed to be out of here in 15 minutes.
Well, I'm sorry I missed some of the presentation. Sherry Hakala, Philadelphia, Building the Poor People's Army. Not to be confused with the Poor People's Campaign. We're not a part of the Democratic Party. I am. So the thing that I want to say is we've got to get off this treadmill. I recently was invited to some very wealthy people's planning meeting to figure out how to prepare for the crisis, the climate crisis. And then we turn back to Kensington, in which people just fall over and die, not just from the opiate crisis, but because they don't have a fan, they don't have an air conditioner, they got asthma, those kinds of things. And so when Jill was talking about some kind of emergency response thing, right, I agree we got to support all these other things, but there's already tons of boots on the ground. And I think that we've got to get away from just supporting whatever the good idea is of the moment, and we got to start measuring stuff. Who's actually got troops? Who's actually doing work out there? And then if it supports what the Green New Deal is about and it supports what we're about, then we need to back it up with our money. That's all I got to say.
Hey, Amber.
I just want to thank Jill and John Lou for showing up at the Line 3 protest. People actually showed up to shut that down, and you two showed up. I want to say thank you.
Okay, let's get one, two more, and we'll get about 3 minutes each to respond.
Just briefly, there's so many issues. We could go through this room and find as many issues as there are people in the room. And the technology is available. We know that it's possible. What's lacking, of course, is the will to do it. And so, how do you focus on that? How do you create that energy, that will to do it? When President Kennedy said we were going to go to the moon in 10 years, nobody had any idea how we were going to get to the moon in 10 years. But the goal was set, and the political will to do it was set. And in part, that's not a good example because it was perceived probably as a military goal, and there's always money for military. But my focus in building messaging and building campaign strategy is in how to link all of those issues to one motivating crisis.
Thank you.
How do we do that?
Okay, well, we see fascists and they sell the mythic past and they also market beer. And we need to market our party better. We need to work on marketing skills. Of course, we're going up against all that money. That's one thing. But the other thing is that we've seen the Democratic Party, a lot of us have left it, and we've seen them co-opt all these different groups. And as soon as a good group comes out working hard, like what your group did, then they come out with their own little group and try to co-opt that. And the thing is, we need to be able to send and have a strategic plan to send Green Party members with an actual focus. Here's your job, you focus on this group. And we pull those groups back to our party, where they should be, where they're going to actually get things done. Do you have an idea? Do you think it's a good idea? Can we do it?
Okay, so we got 11 minutes left. So why don't you take four or five, and I'll take what's left. You want to go first?
I don't need 4 minutes. I can do this with two.
Okay.
Because I think it's important just to kind of touch on a number of the points that were raised. And I will repeat my refrain. We've got to put politics in command. So that it's important to have sort of technocratic sort of responses to these issues, but we've got to understand we are involved in a political, ideological struggle.
Yes.
We're involved in a struggle to build power. We've got to have strategic focus if you understand that that is our task. So
there's all kind of issues, of course. But for the Green Party, we need to determine how do we move forward? How do we build this party? And what are the issues that we embrace that reflect our values that also will allow for us to build the party? Now, I think it's quite clear that, you know, we own and should own this idea of the Green New Deal. Both aspects of it. The next big issue we connect to that, of course, is the issue of war and militarism. That's our issue. It should be our issue. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is the issue of improved Medicare for all. Now, yes. The Democrats have kind of taken that piece too, to a certain extent. But, you know, we've got to have a strategic focus that will allow us to build a party that will differentiate us from the Democratic Party, and which we know will be the issues going forward. Because the contradictions of this system aren't going away. They're only going to intensify, right? So we keep this in mind. Strategic focus, meaning if someone raised the question, why can't we have I took it like a resolution process at these national meetings, where the party says on the national level, you know, we have to always suggest to the state parties, but we can come up with sets of issues that we think are important and that will move us forward strategically. Okay, we got to have a platform struggle, if you will, in 2020 that defines who the Green Party is and how we're going to move. I said 2 minutes. Let me end here by saying that again, issues around property ownership, social relations of production, that sounds too mechanical, but these are the issues we have to deal with when we're talking about trying to transform this society. Because the Democrats, people like Elizabeth Warren, they're laying out green capitalism and it's sounding good to people, okay? We've got to be able to critique that and move the people's understanding and imagination beyond that. Last thing. The issue of consumption and transforming how we live is absolutely critical. The 10% of the global population in the U.S. and Europe cannot continue to consume over 40% of the global resources. It can't happen. There has to be a change.
I'll piggyback on that real quickly. First, some other things that we can do. And it's not only, you know, the small percent that live in the privileged countries of the West, the dominant nations of North America and Europe. A small percentage of the population that is using most of the energy and has created most of the havoc that's out there destroying the lives of poor people. But it's also by income level. It's not just industry, it's not just country, it's actually income. And Kevin Anderson, who's like the Jim Hansen, the climate guru of the UK, he makes the point that the top 1% actually generates about 50% of the greenhouse gases. So when you talk about the impacts of population, I like to point out that it's the population of the wealthy that actually is most destructive to the environment. So, you know, if you want to talk about population balance, that's where it matters most. The wealthy people who are trying to inflict it on poor people around the world, that's where it matters, you know. So limit family size of wealthy people. The other thing I wanted to say on that same order, it's now been quantified what it does to the climate. If you are fortunate enough to be able to take an airplane from the U.S. to Europe, or across country. This is a little known statistic, but it's out there. You can Google it. It's been written up by, you know, a lot of reputable major media, though they try to hide it. But it is true that if you fly across country or if you fly from the Eastern Seaboard to London, you round trip, you basically are destroying a 5.5 foot by 5.5 foot patch of sea ice. That's what the, so it's not like, oh, some theoretical thing. This is what that greenhouse gas footprint is actually goodbye 5 foot by 5 foot. So if you're flying with a few family members, you're carving out a very big patch, you know, and we're at the point where that really matters. So, you know, really important to think about what you're doing, especially on high impact actions like airplanes and meat consumption. It doesn't mean you have to go vegan, but you really do want to cut back on meat consumption if you want to make a difference.
Everybody
no
should
red meat. Other things. Oh, it turns out, I don't know if people saw this, but there's some very good news out there also. It's been now really well documented that we can draw down two-thirds of all cumulative greenhouse gases. Two-thirds can be drawn down by planting 1 trillion trees at 30 cents apiece. It's $300 billion, which is nothing. And it will have maximum impact. It may take 50 years for maximum impact, 50 to 100 years, but that is huge. It means that we can turn this around. And if we zero out our greenhouse gas productions, including by reducing consumption, not only by moving to renewables, but by really massively reducing our consumption at the same time that we are planting trees, we can actually get this thing done. And then finally, it sounds like the major, you know, discussion here is about strategy. And I'll just say two things about strategy. You know, one is that the more of an activist party we are, the more we are out in the street and doing stuff in a collegial and joyful way, the more contagious that is, and the more good people we bring into the party to join us in that work. If we're out there bickering and fighting and purging and, you know, and saying who's a green and who's not, you know, it doesn't create the atmosphere for drawing people in and for good collegial work. So yes, we need to do a lot of work around what our values are and what our program is and our agenda. It takes a lot of hard-working committees to do that. And if you want to get your committees moving, you got to bring good people into the party, and you got to do that by creating a welcoming and functioning place. So we need to do stuff. We need to, you know, and but not only do stuff, we need to recruit people who do stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we really need to bring in the young people who are always out there leading the charge of social transformation. So there's a long-term project.
I'm going to try to touch on 3 points in 1 minute. I won't do that, so we're going to be a couple minutes late. The question of should we not do renewables because mineral extraction is exploitive of miners? I think that's basically the point made. We're exploiting miners now for cars and all the other stuff we're building. The question not is do we use the minerals for things we need, but what are the conditions under which these people are working? And I don't believe we can shop our way out of this crisis. We need major federal government action, social ownership, and democratic administration of the economy. If people are worried about excess consumption, don't go out to people saying they got to sacrifice. The working class in this country can't pay their bills. The living expectancies of people in the lower income communities are 20 years less than the more affluent communities. You make that message, you're going to turn them over to the Koch brothers and their manipulative advertising. What we need is democratic control so we can decide what we want. We can shrink the economy in terms of GDP, which is exchange value, right? By ending planned obsolescence and having more use value. And we will have more and use less materials. That's an eco-socialist framework, and I think we need to start thinking in that way. In terms of the money, somebody made a good point. If we have to bond on Wall Street, which basically means the Treasury issues bonds, primary market, the bond dealers back it. Sometimes the Fed will back that up in the secondary market by buying those bonds to support the market. That's debt financing. I would argue we can do a lot of debt as long as we're a reserve currency in the world, but it's not a good choice because what do? When we go into debt? We're transferring our wealth to the rich, and we're squeezing the budget with interest payments. So that's the green quantitative easing that Ellen Brown has been talking about. We can do that, and it's better to do that than do nothing, because if we do nothing, it's going to cost us more. because this crisis is going to kill us. The better solution we have in the green platform, the greening the dollar, the greenbacks. That would be the authority to create money that's in the Treasury Department, and they spend it directly in the economy on this infrastructure. But we got to do one or the other. So the monetary question, we need to stay on top of. The last thing I'll say, you know, Jennifer said the fascists rely on fear. And what do they rely on? Xenophobia, racism, fact-free irrationalism, authoritarianism of people that are all freaked out and want Big Daddy to solve it for them.
Sexy.
And we just saw in the European Parliament elections, the right underperformed and the Greens overperformed, running on a hopeful Green New Deal that focused on the climate crisis, social supports, stronger democracy, and the Green Party movement in Germany, I mean in Europe, is the only political trend in Europe that doesn't have a xenophobic trend. Even the far left, a lot of those parties in France and in Germany, the Linke, they got an anti-immigrant faction. And so do the Social Democrats. One thing we can be proud of with the Greens, even if we might criticize them, I would as a socialist, on their economics. They haven't succumbed to racism, they've been the people fighting xenophobia, and they got good results from that. So I think the hopeful thing is if we run on a positive program, we're going to get support. So thank you. And recommendation to whoever organizes this, we need more than an hour.
Awesome. We should put this in some of the larger auditorium.
We're done according to the schedule. It's dinner time. I think the panelists are happy to talk. So I think we're doing it informally.
Howie, who's that?
There's more good of you. The next global economic class that
Yeah, there was quite a few people who were in our I saw it.
Wow.
If I knew how to turn this off, I would. How to turn it off. That's the stop button.
I think right there.
Right there?
Where the red button is pushed in. And we want